You're listening to Aperitivo, first broadcast on the 31st of October 2013 here on Monocle 24. Aperitivo is brought to you in association with the Glenlivet. Hello from Midori House here in London, and welcome to Aperitivo, coming to you live from Studio One, just down the road from Monocle Cafe. I'm Tyler Brulé on today's show.
I think in terms of prospects for a negotiated solution to the conflict, we're no nearer that. What I think it does show, though, is that the Russians, you know, have the ability to deliver the regime.
Syria peace talks, press regulation, and the future of newspapers. George Brock and Robert Fox are here to pore over the day's top news stories. Then veteran journalist David Page is here to discuss a new photo exhibition showcasing Afghanistan through the eyes of its people. And our own Sophie Grove meets gallerist Louisa Guinness for coffee and conversation at the Monocle Cafe.
Specifically, what I'm doing is I'm working with artists whose main work is sculpture or painting. And I have invited them to create another medium and another dimension.
All that plus the music, and we'll look ahead to the rest of the day here on Monocle 24. That's Aperitivo with me, Tyler Brulé, right here on Monocle 24. A lot ahead over the next 58 and a half minutes here from Studio One at Midori House. But before all of that, though, Mr. David Spencer's here with the world news.
Thank you, Monocle 24 News. I'm David Spencer. The Global Chemical Weapons Watchdog says Syria has met Friday's deadline and destroyed all its declared chemical weapons production equipment. The OPCW says it means that the inspectors have completed all but two of the 23 chemical weapons inspections across sites in Syria. Those two were deemed too dangerous to inspect, but the chemical equipment had already been moved to other sites which had been inspected. A petition signed by 1.5 million people has been handed to a police chief in the Kenyan capital, Nairobi, demanding stiffer punishment for a gang who raped a 16-year-old girl. Activists marched through the city before handing over the document, which expresses anger at how officers ordered three of the suspects to cut the grass outside a police station as punishment. The teenage victim was attacked on her way back from a family funeral in June and is now confined to a wheelchair. Nabila Abdulmelek of the African Women Development and Communication Network is one of the organisers of the demonstration.
I think this is one step, but we still have a long way to go. It's nice to see that the our petition, which had over 1.2 million signatures, was received by the Office of the Inspector General, even though it wasn't the Inspector General himself. And I'm also assured that they've asked us to come in for a sit-down meeting, because I think this is the opportunity now to sit down with them and set up benchmarks and time frames and timelines and see how we can work together to strengthen the systems that have not protected us.
China has expressed its concern after a report in the Sydney Morning Herald said Australian embassies across Asia were being used as part of an American spying operation. The paper said the intelligence collection also takes place in other diplomatic missions, including in Beijing, but without most of the Australian diplomats knowing about it. Rescue workers in Niger have found the bodies of 87 would-be migrants who died of thirst after their vehicles broke down in the Sahara as they were trying to reach Algeria. More than half of them were women and children. Five bodies were reported to have been found on Monday. The rest were discovered on Wednesday. It's not clear where the migrants came from. Tens of thousands of people have taken part in marches across Mozambique to protest against the threat of armed conflict in the country and a spate of kidnappings by criminal gangs. Carrying signs reading "We want peace and stop the kidnappings," the protesters criticised the government for not doing enough to protect citizens as it confronts attacks by armed guerrillas of the Renamo opposition movement. Raids and ambushes by the group since April have killed dozens of civilians, police and soldiers. Aviation regulators in the United States have cleared the safe use of some mobile devices during takeoff and landing for US airlines. Carriers are expected to let passengers use smartphones, tablets, and e-book readers from gate to gate by the end of the year. But mobile phone calls will remain banned because of the possibility of radio interference with flight equipment. Michael Fuerta from the Federal Aviation Administration said it means more flexibility for passengers.
It's safe to read downloaded materials like ebooks and calendars, and also to play games. But the committee found that in some instances of low visibility, about 1% of all flights, some landing systems may not be proven to tolerate the interference. In those cases, passengers may be asked to turn off devices.
Michael Fuerta from the Federal Aviation Administration. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much for that, David. More from you in about 25 minutes' time. You're listening to Aperitivo here on Monocle 24. We're back after this.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Tu vai Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. See on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Monocle 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
And you're listening to Aperitivo here on Monocle 24. Time in London right now, it's 18.06. If you're listening on the North American East Coast, it is 14.06. And joining me here in studio with her take on the news from across the day so far is George Brock, head of journalism at City University here in London. And of course, author of Out of Print, Newspapers, Journalism and the Business of News in the Digital Age. We'll be coming to that topic in much more detail a little bit later. We're talking about some decent results by the New York Times. Also, Robert Fox is here, defense editor at London's Evening Standard newspaper. Good evening and welcome, gentlemen.
Hello.
I guess first a little bit about the book. As I said, in a moment, certainly Bloomberg has been reporting, they almost sort of cock-a-hoop about it all afternoon, about some decent results from the New York Times. But tell us a little bit about Out of Print for those who haven't come across it yet.
Well, I was irritated beyond measure by everybody going on about doom and gloom in journalism. I went to seminar after seminar and people were telling me journalism was coming to an end. And I thought, I just can't see this. This isn't right.
That's why you're on the show today.
Exactly. I'm an optimist. I'm a little ray of sunshine, and the book is supposed to be a little ray of sunshine because it says two things. One is, if you look at the history of journalism, it's constantly being disrupted. Mm-hmm. And secondly, if you actually look at the grassroots of what people are doing that can legitimately be called journalism, there's lots and lots of new stuff growing. It's just a bit tough in the big institutions, including the New York Times, but we're going to come to that later.
We are. I'm not going to ask about this autumn's crop of students yet, but I might in a moment. Where does the book take us, George? Are you spinning us around the globe? Is it just told from the streets of this city?
No, certainly not. Firstly, there are continents where newspapers are still growing. Mm-hmm. Let's not forget they're growing hard in Brazil, China, and India, to take three big examples. So actually, the global picture is quite mixed. And in the States, the discovery of online journalism and rediscovering what readers actually need, in some ways, is a process that's gone a bit further because conventional newspapers tended to collapse a bit quicker in the US than they did in Europe.
Yeah, we were very keen, of course, on telling the odd sunny story here. And I was talking to Gunilla Hurlitz, and she's the CEO at Sweden's Dagens Nyheter. And they've had, a tough two decades. Let's not even talk about digital. They've had a hard time. And they said, 2014 coming up, they said, paper is doing, incredibly well. They think that they figured out it's going to be one of the stories that's in our December, January issue. But it's interesting to see that there are rays of sunshine. It takes, a while for people to figure, get through the muddle. But some major groups are figuring it out.
Yeah, and print is not going to disappear. I mean, the business model for daily general interest printed papers, pretty tough. Mm. But weekend papers, magazines, books, all under pressure, but doing relatively better.
Now, from time to time, I come and have the odd chat at your school. What is the new crop of students like? And how are they feeling? Because I remember being at the school about 3 years ago, and there were a lot of sort of very long or almost confused faces. A lot of students saying, God, it's tough. I was talking to, some of the graduates from, last year, and they're finding it, very difficult out there. We're confused. Should I be, building up my profile, solely as a blogger? Heaven forbid. What should I be doing? And I'm wondering, how does the class feel so far this year?
They're still a little nervy, and it's understandable that they're nervy, because their elders go around being so pessimistic. But it is tough. It's tough getting off the ground in this kind of economic climate. It's very difficult. We just We don't say to them, we can tell you what the future will be. We say we will do our absolute best to equip you to navigate it. But we've enrolled a record number of postgraduates this year, and undergraduates we recruited absolutely fine. So despite all those elders saying, I wouldn't go into journalism if I were you, dear, they seem to be doing it all the same.
And Robert, over at Evening Standard Towers, are the editorial floors flooded with bright-faced young journalists coming in?
They're flooded with applicants. You can see the centre pages. And it is a thing that where it was supposed to be knocking on the undertaker's door just 2 or 3 years back. We're now distributing 600,000 copies a day on a model which they swore would not work. Mm. It's peculiar to London, but the fact is that this paper is a tabloid, lower mid-market, it's a free sheet, and it doesn't look like one. Mm. And it's an amazing trick, and it's keeping other things going. It's keeping the Independent going. But I'd just like to say I'm absolutely with George on this, because it is a condition of humanity, it seems to me, as long as we use words and speech and we're rational, news is always out there. This is the thing where the gloomsters go completely wrong. Mm. News is going to take different forms, but since it's speech and words and writing, the print still will be strong, and it's making the print model work, which is so interesting. And it's very interesting to see who's being successful around the world. Mm. And I think we've got to be a little less insular. In Britain, the problem is, and I know is most of our listeners must realise, it's this concentration of a metropolitan press in London. It is quite unusual. I won't say it's completely unusual. You look at the proliferation of newspapers in Latin America now, and I think we're a little bit obsessive. So every squeak, everything, of course, we have the trial at the moment. Mm-hmm. Maybe we'll talk about that. Maybe we won't. And we are a touch obsessive. And part of the problem, I think, is looking at things in old-fashioned terms. Sorry to be a bit parochial, but The Guardian has looked for years at the possibility of migrating to be electronic and online. This is the vision of Alan Rusbridger. But if you look at global newspapers, global brands that we are discussing here, look what the Financial Times has done as a global newspaper, how it's balancing the mix between online, between blogs and reporting and so on. And this is the paper we're talking about today, the New York Times. Mm. And that's the trick that they're trying to pull. But just to finish with what George was saying, it's the 150th anniversary of the American Civil War. The New York Times is running a series for those who are interested. They're pertinent. They're superb essays, by the way, called Disunion. And it's all online. And it's a stunning example of how to do it. It's slightly minority-ish, but it has a terrific take-up. And it's exclusively in the blogosphere for them.
Hmm. Let's come back to newspapers in a little bit, because I want to spend a lot of time on them. But I think we should probably head over to Syria. Of course, everyone heard in the bulletin at the top of the hour on this program, but I think everywhere else on so many other outlets. Of course, the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, some reasonably good news. It looks like they are going to be hitting this deadline tomorrow. And Robert, I wanted to talk. I want to start with you on this note. I mean, is this symbolically, this is meaningful, but it also seemed incredibly swift. And I'm wondering how thorough has this process been?
Well, I think they've been very, very intelligent about this. And what they have said is that they have verified as much as they can, and they've said they haven't been able to get into the two sites which are in rebel hands and are very dangerous. But they believe and understand that the stocks have been removed from those sites. That indeed is what the regime is saying. But let's be absolutely clear that the heavy lifting in this round has been done by the regime. The team from the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, it's quite a smallish team, and they have been assisted by the Syrian army and so on. What they have said is that they have verified that the equipment for making chemical weapons is now destroyed as far as they can verify it in all but these two sites. They don't think there's significant stuff there. But wait for it. You're absolutely right, Tyler. It's going to take at least a year, and I think probably a lot longer, to destroy the stocks. It's an incredibly delicate process. It's not an unknown. It's been done successfully before. People do know how to do it. A lot of patience is required. But one of the things I was just telling George before, I've been amongst military folk over the past 24 hours. And one of the things I was horrified to be told on good authority that part of the targeting, were there to have been an Allied strike led by the Americans at the end of August, was on chemical dumps. That's a terrific risk. Even the open source literature points out what a terrible risk is, because you risk an ecological disaster. But this is good. You're quite right. The symbolism of it is now we get to the next diplomatic stage. And that is the really interesting thing now.
George, I just wanted to look at this from a media tack for a moment. I mean, there has been a demobilization of the media. We don't see as many stand-ups on rooftops, etc. And of course, for some organizations, journalists are thin on the ground, maybe not so thin for the likes of Al Jazeera and Al Arabiya. But nevertheless, you know, there of course, it's not as much of certainly the top of the news wheel at the moment. Given what's happening, you know, are you surprised by the appetites of editors that there's maybe not, you know, a few more people out there, and that Syria hasn't jumped a little bit further up the agenda?
This is a very, very long-run civil war. I think if you have a civil war of this kind that goes on for this kind of duration, you're bound to get some ups and downs. Mm. And in the last few weeks, it's pretty obvious that on the rebel side, some of the reporting has got significantly more dangerous. I mean, given the number of people who've already been killed in Syria, I wouldn't blame any foreign editor for being fairly cautious about allowing people back in by the back door, so to speak, on the rebel side. But can I just say on the stocks, I mean, they've done what you have to do in the first bit, which is to seal all this stuff down, lock it down. But the really difficult stuff is destroy, as Robert says, just to underline it, is either to move it or destroy it. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's really the hard stuff. There's a thousand tons of precursor chemicals, 300 tons of stuff they'd actually made, which I think they denied ever having in the first place. Clear they've now got it. And, you know, that's quite a big task in its own right. And one other thing, we all, it's quite understandable that people are interested in the chemical weapons and so on, and all of the people being killed in horrible ways. But the biggest problem that is being caused by this civil war is the refugee community. Yeah. I was in Amman in Jordan in June, and I was only in Amman, but, you know, there was a village of 5,000 people which has turned into a town of 250,000 people in tents. And this is going on all over the Syrian perimeter. I mean, there's a lot of understandable argument about exactly what proportion of the population is missing, so to speak. But, I mean, they are now spreading out quite a long way. They're in these communities where it is a miracle, as far as I can see, and that's what all the people in the aid agencies say, there's been no big outbreak of major disease.
Mm. Robert, we're very fortunate to have you in the studio today. For those people who don't read the sidebars and go and follow the technical detail, what happens now if we're in a lockdown situation, when we come to actually then destroying these weapons, you know, what is that process? Who's involved? What are the safeguards like? Where do we go? And I know that this is probably there's a full, you know, week long documentary series in this. But.
Yeah, I'll just give you some signposts. They'll go back to the UN because they have to come to an agreement with the regime, which they will do because they've started. They've got to go on with it about disposal. We do have a template for this because actually the disposal, for obvious reasons, we didn't hear too much about it. The disposal of Saddam Hussein's stocks. After the 91 war over Kuwait, in 92 and 93, was particularly successful, by the way, led by the same types of people that we've got down on the ground now, just having completed this phase. It's very delicate because what I would say this, quite apart from the refugees, which is a huge problem, this is an immensely complex civil war. I don't mean to patronize by a cliche. There are so many little wars within this one. And actually, the blogosphere, things like Conflict Forum, which I subscribe to, with Alistair Crook, who does a roundup, what you're getting from the Turkish borders, from Kurdistan, is, I mean, we've heard about the Al-Qaeda thing, but there is a revival of the PKK, the people of the Kurdish Workers' Party, in different forms. And Erdogan is instrumental, that is the Prime Minister of Turkey, is instrumentalizing it for his own gains. And now we've got the political diplomatic story, which is possibly a game changer, is where Saudi Arabia is going. When we had Prince Bandar and Prince Turkey, This is a big shift because, curiously, the person who isn't changing on this is Obama. And Obama is not going to get his hand in the mangle on this one. So we will now go through a whole phase of this. I think the refugee stories become stronger. It is a very, very dangerous war. And I wouldn't want to do this to report because you do not know who you're dealing with at any time. And that's why it's so dangerous for the reporter on the ground. And you can't just do it from rooftops anymore.
Robert Fox and George Brock are with me in the studio. We're going to come back to not this discussion. We want to move it on to that press tack again. Talk about a little bit about what's happening in the courts in London. Also, the New York Times story as well. You're listening to Aperitivo here on Monocle 24. Short break. We're back after this.
The rugged and romantic Scottish Highlands are not the Glenlivet's only inspiration. Since 1824, this single malt has combined unique flavours to create one of the world's most awarded whiskies. The Guardian's Chapter is their next limited edition whisky, with a taste that will be decided by the Glenlivet's own community of enthusiasts from around the world. To discover more and write the next chapter of the legacy, join the Guardians at theglenlivet.com. The Glenlivet. The single malt that started it all. Enjoy responsibly.
Geneva, 1821 here in London, and you're listening to Aperitivo here on Monocle 24. I am joined by George Brock from City University here in London, also Robert Fox of the Evening Standard, certainly on the defence side of that paper as well. And in the defence of papers, we've, of course, everyone's been watching with some delight, surprise, shock, maybe not so much, certainly what's been happening. And I wanted to maybe start also for our listeners who might be sitting in Auckland and they're not so close to the story. And again, I think also it's always very, very nice as well that Robert doesn't want to keep it too parochial in London. But this is a massive story, certainly in this country. Maybe bring us up to speed. Give us the 30-second version for our listeners elsewhere. What's going on in this media circus, George, in London right now?
Well, the first of the really big trials arising out of the phone hacking scandal has now begun at the Old Bailey. We're still in the early days of the prosecution case. We haven't got further than that. It took quite a long time to get off the ground. Quite a lot of defendants. It's a sort of interlocking offences trial. It's not just phone hacking. There's conspiracy to pervert the course of justice and bribing public officials, both incidentally much more serious offences in English law than phone hacking. There's a kind of Greek tragedy aspect to it. The two principal defendants are Rebecca Brooks, who was the editor of The Sun and The News of the World, and then the head of the Rupert Murdoch newspaper company in Britain, Andy Coulson, editor of The News of the World, then later chief spin doctor for David Cameron. These are the two. These were in their day extremely powerful, very influential kind of media, popular media magnates who politicians are happy to prostrate themselves in front of. And here they are at the Old Bailey, struggling for their lives. This trial is supposed to last 5 months' time, which tells us that most of the defendants are going to try and fight most of the charges most of the way. So it's going to be a long, drag-out fight.
And how does this story, you know, certainly being at a paper like The Standard, which I'm sure there's been a bit of combing around there, as there has been with every newspaper, Robert, you know, how is it viewed from the editor's desk as well? And, you know, is there that sense, I guess, you know, a clear sense of sort of, you know, camaraderie on one side, but thank goodness they didn't come through, you know, our revolving doors.
It's a juicy story. It's got everything in it. And that's why, you know, the pure journalism in it, it's, don't get me wrong, I'm not making any moral strictures, but it's attractive in that way. But there are two things. It's absolutely, do you really want to go on Dog Eats Dog?
Mm.
Because there is great concern about the future of the print media, not in the sense commercially, in the way that George was talking earlier, but in the way that how you're going to regulate it, because we did have an inquiry by Lord Justice Leveson into this whole business. And I'm really rather sorry to say, because I sound sort of man and boy, I've been a journalist over 45 years, and I've split my time roughly 50-50 between broadcast and print, and very happily so. I was really quite upset at the feeding frenzy that you got, particularly from the broadcasters, about the print world. They are as they are in any country, in any journalistic culture, very closely interwoven. The BBC's news agenda would not exist but for the newspapers in the way things are structured right now. I am quite worried about the regulations, and I'm extremely interested that are being proposed, which is a charter which will be underpinned by statute for quasi self-regulation, but absolute regulation, in that it will offer quite serious redress if you think you've been wronged by a newspaper. Mm. This is, I think, something quite new for Britain, for England. Ireland has done it quite successfully. In the United States, it's entirely different because you've got the First Amendment, which, by the way, seriously, has been invoked only in two major cases. One was Daniel Ellsberg and the Pentagon Papers. So, well, I've moved away from the trial to this. This is what's going on. It's where are we going with all this? I do share George's robust optimism. I do think the news business is going to go on, but I do think times are changing.
My role here is a little ray of sunshine. I'm here to tell you, Robert, that I think things are on regulation are going to be fine.
Yeah.
Apart from anything else, let's just look at the global dimension here. You're in the Foreign Office in London. You sidle up to the Prime Minister and you say, look, Prime Minister, if you pass this regulation scheme, boy, are you going to get teased by Vladimir Putin.
Yeah.
My advice is kick this into the long grass if you can. Okay, sorry to be British domestic for 1 second, but we have an election season starting at about 6 to 9 months' time here in Britain. All the government has to do, and it has tied itself in a fantastically complicated knot. The legislation is an appalling nightmare to make work. All it's got to do is basically spin things out for 6 or 9 months, and every politician in Westminster, however much they might have wanted to take revenge on popular papers, is just going to have to concentrate on something else.
Okay.
And the potential embarrassment, very big embarrassment international, might actually go away.
The good news, you heard it here first. Yeah. I want to let's jump the Atlantic, let's go over to New York and talk about the New York Times for a moment. Interesting here that they're now saying readers are contributing, you know, more to that paper's revenue than advertisers. Quite extraordinary. And the news today is that print advertising has improved in the third quarter. The publisher's online ad sales did not. Which is interesting, and subscribers are now making up that difference. Circulation sales, they say, rose by 4.8% to 204 million, and the company posted a 28% increase in digital subscribers, and now at 727,000. George, what do you make of that?
Well, Tyler, let's be very careful about short-term figures. When they said it did better in advertising revenue, what it meant was it didn't do as badly as the previous two quarters.
Exactly.
Okay, it's a relative improvement. Now, we are going to see in most of these media companies, which the New York Times is absolutely typical because they're mixed in their print online, they're trying to find the right balance between the two. As economies in general improve gently, we will see some better figures. Don't let's mistake that for the long trend, which is a huge shift between print and digital. Yeah. I don't mean by that the print is going to disappear. Mm-hmm. What I mean is that it's going to be a less significant strand of the business, of how people learn about news in the whole picture.
Mm.
And the shift towards circulation revenue and away from advertising revenue is the really big change that is going on here. The whole of the last part of the 20th century, everybody had an absolutely, well, relatively, stable platform for journalism commercially, TV and print. In came the advertising, up to three quarters of the income. That world is gone.
But it is interesting to see, though, that with all of this, you know, doom and gloom that everyone talks about, though, here we're reading that online ads fell twice as fast as those in the physical paper. So we're often talking here about there's this great correction going on, that everyone has made this mad, you know, dash and rush. And, you know, we had a major U.S. advertiser here this morning who spends a lot of money with the New York Times. And they said, we can just see it. You know, we can see it now. We did, you know, all kinds of things, digital kinds of experiments, social, etc. But, you know, when we do something in a newspaper, regional or national, it still delivers for us. And do you think more people are coming back to that, and that's why they're enjoying that? Or
I slightly doubt, Tyler, that just watch for the next set of figures, because there is an enormous amount of experimentation going on in how you sell digital advertising. And the algorithm boys are getting into this game now. And one of the clues that Mark Thompson has offered is, this is disruption caused by the fact that we didn't handle this algorithm stuff right.
Right.
So it may be a blip.
Robert.
Very quickly, what you've just outlined was the hidden secret success of the Standard. And the Lebedevs, it must be said, bet on this. And it was the quality as well as the quantity of advertising that suddenly turned the thing round. And it was really very effective. As I said, it is a particular model in a very particular city. All I'd like to say, we've talked quantity here. The interesting thing for me about the New York Times is the quality is still there. I have to put my hand up. Online and in print, it is the first newspaper I read, and often very early in the morning. Because if it's the big backgrounder in my areas of interest, which are not just defense and all that, but it's, you know, global shifts, climate change, this, that, and the other, even business, I get the fast summary because they will have closed later. And then I go to the Financial Times at the top end and then start reading the sports pages, I have to confess. But the offer is still tremendous.
And just before we go, gentlemen, have either of you gotten your head around IHT versus Innit now? How do you sort of feel about the international New York Times? From a branding point of view, is that just to get us, oh God, I'm not going to do the international, but it's just the New York Times?
It's just the New York Times. I do wish they'd stop messing around with the titles. It's just so boring.
It is. Sir?
It's because I think there was a real change. You know, things happened in Paris. I still slightly miss that very, very peculiar marriage between the Washington Post and the New York Times.
I love that.
You've got wonderful columnists. They still have very, very good columnists, but it was the mixed. It was the slight grittiness. It was like a quarrelling married couple, and it was brilliant.
But for all the quality, when it became New York Times only, it became a little bit duller.
Yes, it did. Yep.
George Brock and Robert Fox. Gentlemen, great to see you here on Aperitif here on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Лондрис, Нова Йорк, Токио.
Лондон, Нью Йорк, Токио. Dette er Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 です.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
And there is still plenty to come in the second half hour of today's Aperitivo. We'll head to the Monocle Cafe to talk photography, and we'll be talking photography in Afghanistan. We'll also preview what's coming up on today's Globalist Asia and Monocle Daily with our presenters and producers. But before that, Mr. David Spencer's back with the bottom of the hour headlines.
Thank you very much indeed. International inspectors say Syria has destroyed all its declared chemical weapons production facilities. The announcement came ahead of Friday's deadline, which had been deemed by some as a challenging timetable for completion. In Kenya, a petition has been handed to police demanding tougher punishment for three men accused of raping a 16-year-old girl. The men were among a group of six who are alleged to have attacked the teenager as she returned home from a funeral in June. Police in Italy say they've dismantled an international ring that conspired to kidnap children involved in custody battles. Police said they charged tens of thousands of dollars for the abductions from North Africa to Europe using high-speed boats. Tens of thousands of people have taken part in marches across Mozambique to protest against the threat of armed conflict in the country and a spate of kidnappings by criminal gangs. Raids and ambushes by an opposition group since April have killed dozens of civilians, police and soldiers. Toronto police say they've recovered a mobile phone video which has been the public centrepiece of a drug scandal surrounding Mayor Rob Ford. The saga has captivated the city since reports surfaced in May of the existence of the video, which appeared to show the mayor smoking a crack pipe. Mr. Ford's insisted he did not use crack cocaine. Passengers on flights in the United States will soon be able to use smartphones, tablets and e-readers from gate to gate after extensive research by authorities. Mobile phone calls, however, are still not approved. Those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much for that, David. And thanks for bringing that depressing news, of course, from Toronto. I don't know what we would do if we didn't have sort of, you know, Toronto and its leadership and also lovely Montreal and all of its corruption scandals. Anyway, it's always nice that you can bring us that. Are you sort of surprised when you sort of look at these? You know, it's like, you know, here you think, you know, Canada, you know, a nice, you know, upstanding, you know, liberal democracy. And I'm looking at the front cover of the Toronto Star right now. Massive story. Rob Ford, police have video that appears to show mayor smoking crack. And there it is. If you ladies don't want to look at that, thestar.com.
It's fascinating how much this has gripped, though, the city since the spring. It's been since May. It's just an extraordinary story that for him wouldn't obviously go away. And this is an interesting development.
Yeah, just saying here, looking at the Star, and the Toronto Star has been, you know, really, you know, one of the papers that has also been at the center of this. And, you know, did they or did they not have the video, etc. And now saying, reported Rob Ford will speak to reporters at Toronto City Hall, and they're going to be coming to that. And I'm sure you will have that story for us. Probably, maybe, who knows? Maybe even at the top of the hour. It's probably lunchtime in Toronto right now. I think they'll wait till the journalists have filled their tummies. David, we'll see you in about 25 minutes. Now, it's not often known that artists such as Picasso, Braque, and Calder also made jewelry, modernist pendants, sculptural rings, and avant-garde masks, artworks designed to be worn. It's this meeting of form and function and precious metal that inspired Louisa Guinness to open a gallery specializing in artist-made jewelry. After many years working in the art world alongside her husband Ben Brown, she set about convincing the contemporary artists she knew, from Ron Arid to Anish Kapoor, to turn their hands to creating jewelry. Louisa now acts as a conduit between the gold and silversmiths of London's Hatton Garden and some of the world's most talented artists. Art jewelry is a growing niche, and Louisa recently opened a new gallery here in London on Conduit Street. She joined our senior editor, Sophie Grove, down at the Monocle Cafe just a bit earlier.
Louisa, welcome to the Monocle Cafe. Wonderful to see you this afternoon. Now, tell me, we're here to talk about your new gallery on Conduit Street. Something very original. This is about artists making jewellery. Tell me about the concept.
Hi, well, thank you for having me. It's original in that this is the first gallery that is focusing on this particular subject, but it's not original in concept, because it's been going on for years. Specifically, what I'm doing is I'm working with artists who are whose main work is sculpture or painting, and I have invited them to create another medium and another dimension and to make jewellery for me. So I'm working with people like Anthony Gormley and Anish Kapoor and Sam Taylor Wood. I did a project with Michael Craig Martin, Damien Hirst, those sort of people who people will know better for their art fairs and large scale pieces. So what we're doing is we're creating wearable sculpture, small sculpture, in limited editions, all signed and numbered. And it's another sort of area where art collectors can enjoy having a wider area of their collection, and also having something fabulous to wear and something quite original and quite interesting and quite different.
I mean, that is the intriguing thing about the idea of wearing an artwork. Does it change the nature of the artwork, the nature of the form in a way, that it's a bit more performative if it's being worn?
Yes, I think when the artists create these pieces, they're not always thinking perhaps about beauty, which a traditional jeweller would be. They would be focusing on the stones or the gems or the content and the material, and then how it would enhance the person's body or the way, the whole appearance. It's about interest, and it's about what they're trying to say, and if they're trying to put a message through their art, they use this jewellery as a different medium. And it generally is comfortable to wear, but it's usually more fabulous than comfortable. And they create a piece which looks amazing on, but also looks amazing off. And this is one of the things that I'm quite focused on, which is that the jewellery must look good when it's at home. I want you to have it on your living room table or on your dressing table, so it doesn't get stuffed away in the safe and forgotten about. It's enjoyed as an artwork. If you can have a Warhol on your wall and look at it every day and enjoy it, why can't you have a sculpture by Man Ray or someone, and then you just take it off the wall and put it on as you go out the door and wear this fabulous piece of art?
It's such a wonderful concept, and I wondered, is there a market growing for this type of artwork, something a bit more malleable, with this wonderful element that you can wear it and transform it with your own person? Who are your customers, and do you think this is you're one of the first people to do this as a gallerist. Do you see this as an emerging area of the art world?
I'd like to think that it is. I think that the main thing is that it's an interesting forum for the artists to have a dialogue between themselves and present their ideas to clients or to customers. Generally, most of the people who are interested from an art point of view. I think 90% of my customers are art collectors, and they'd be buying the works as an extension of already something that they collect. But some of the people buy it for, it's just artistic merit. They want to just have something quite interesting and different. And I think the market is growing, but the market's growing kind of naturally in that there are more and more artists creating more and more of these works. And through that, there are more people buying them and more people seeing them, and then there's a word of mouth and someone says, hey, where did you get that? I really like that. Oh, I got it in Louisa Guinness gallery. Oh, well, there you go, off you go. And then they come along, and then I'm doing more fairs, so people see what's going on at fairs. There's more newspaper articles. People are just generally interested, and I think part of it is because people didn't know that it existed. I mean, I have jewellery by Picasso, by Man Ray, by Max Ernst, and when people come into the gallery and they see it, they go, oh my God, I didn't know that Picasso made jewellery, for example. And that's the whole fun and interesting thing about it. And actually, that's kind of where it all started from, is that I started collecting older jewellery. And then I noticed that none of today's artists were making it. And so since I knew quite a lot of the artists through my husband, I decided to start working with them, where I asked them if they would be interested in doing collaborations, and that's how the whole thing has developed. And yeah, I think the market is, and there are exhibitions. This is another interesting area to talk about. There's a lovely lady called Diane Venet, who's a big collector and sort of promoter of the market, or the world as it were, and she's just putting on an exhibition opening in Korea in the next month. It's been in New York, it's been in Miami, we're hoping to bring it to London, and it's, the show had something like 250 pieces by 150 different artists, so it is, it's exciting, it's really exciting.
And tell me a bit about yourself and your relationship with the artists themselves. Did it take any persuasion on your part to get some artists and sculptors to really turn their hand to making jewellery? I mean, did anybody seem a little bit reticent to sort of branch out and do something completely different that is to be worn and does have a different concept in many ways?
I don't think anyone took any major persuasion. Some of the projects haven't worked out, not because they didn't want to do them, just because we couldn't get them to something that we were all satisfied with. Not many, but a couple of things. Mostly the artists are really keen. The biggest challenge one finds is time in everyone's life. It's the story of all our lives right now. The artists love doing it. I go and see them. I've just had a big meeting this morning with Anish Kapoor, taking forward a new piece which we're hoping to present at the end of the month. And he's given me ideas of what he wants me to do. I've actually also, that's where I was late. I was at the Goldsmiths, went straight there, told them what we want to do, said I need to have that prototype back by next Thursday so we can develop it and to get it back to him, to get it back. It's time is just the biggest issue. And also because this is a small project in a, for example, someone like him, a major artist's oeuvre. It's a little cog in the wheel, you know. It's only a small part of it, so he can't afford to spend huge amounts of time on it. But
well, Louisa Guinness, thank you so much for joining me in the Monocle Cafe.
Thank you very much for having me.
And that was our Sophie Grove talking to Louisa Guinness, just down the road, about 200 metres, just from this very studio. Up next, as NATO troops begin to leave Afghanistan next year, we'll take a photographic look at the country's past 30 years. You're listening to Aperitivo here on Monocle 24.
The Glenlivet was the first single malt to successfully cross the Atlantic Ocean. And since that first journey, the world-renowned whiskey has never looked back. Now, master distiller Alan Winchester is inviting their global community of whiskey connoisseurs, the guardians of the Glenlivet, to help create their next limited edition whiskey. To discover more and write the next chapter of the legacy, join the guardians at theglenlivet.com. The Glenlivet, the single malt that started it all. Enjoy responsibly.
Thank you. In Istanbul, they took to the streets in a battle for green space. In Sao Paulo, they marched in their thousands in a fight for cheaper buses. In Athens, they shouted loud to demand a better-run capital. And every week in London, there's a rollerblading convoy that reclaims the streets for the pedestrians and pedal pushers. That's why urbanism matters, why words like density, infrastructure, and smart cities need to be dragged out of city hall conclaves and turned into a public debate. And that's why every week, Monocle's show, The Urbanist, reports from cities around the world that are getting horribly wrong and deliciously right, visits the mavericks and mayors with a vision further than the edge of their desk, and asks the questions that will shape how we live tomorrow.
To me, placemaking is a sacred community process. It's about an organic way that communities can evolve and shape the spaces that are important to them.
Every 20 years, the city gets rebuilt. There's probably not a lot of cities in the world that gets rebuilt every 20 years.
People respond to variety, and cities need a richness and diversity.
Oh, and we take time to savour the softer side of metropolitan living too, from the need for playfulness to places to pause in the melee. Presented by me, Andrew Tuck, The Urbanist premieres every Thursday at 1900 London time, and you can also download it from monocle.com or iTunes.
And welcome back to Aperitivo here on Monocle 24 with me, Tyler Brulé. It's just 5:46. If you're listening in Melbourne, it's 18:46 here in London. Well, NATO's mission and America's longest war will finally, or at least officially, come to an end in December 2014, just over a year from now. The conflict in Afghanistan has an uncertain future, and the legacy and the future of the West's involvement is rather murky. This is only the latest period of political violence to take hold of the country. Coups, invasions, and corruption have dominated headlines for decades. One group that's been and certainly seen its fair share of changes and upheaval in the country is Afghan Aid, which has operated there for over 30 years and presently has 400 staff operating out of its Kabul office. On Tuesday of next week, the organization launches 30 Years, 30 Stories, a photography exhibition documenting the lives of everyday Afghans since 1983. David Page is chair of Afghan Aid's Board of Trustees. David is a veteran journalist involved in the creation of the BBC's Pashto service in 1981, and before that ran the Urdu service from 1977 to 1985. Mr. Page, welcome to studio.
Very nice to be here.
I'm just looking at a color proof that you brought into the studio. And there's this wonderful picture of a gentleman. His name is Amin. He's a driver. It looks like he might be standing in front of a Mitsubishi or a Toyota, one of the many vehicles that certainly rumble along the Khyber Pass. And this is it's interesting. And this is the first image I saw, because this is how sort of my journey to Afghanistan started in Peshawar as well. Really deciding on. Did you like the cut of the jib of this driver versus another one, and eventually just have to say, this probably looks like the best option, and away you go. Tell us about the narrative, not of the book, but also how this exhibition plays out.
Well, the exhibition is to mark the 30 years, and we decided to commission Leslie Knott and Clem Malpass, who Tiger Nest Films. I mean, they've got an excellent track record in making documentaries. I think Leslie made a very good documentary on the Afghan cricket team, and they've both between them made a number of very well-received documentaries. And they went out to Afghanistan, and they went to the remote provinces where we work, Badakhshan in the northeast, Samangan in the central area, and Ghor in the west. And they visited some of the project sites that we were working on, and they interviewed staff, and they interviewed beneficiaries, and we've compiled the book really from the stories of those people. And the book attempts to, if you like, tell the story of Afghan Aid those 30 years, or almost 30 years, through these individuals. So you get a picture of the staff, and we have a very loyal, committed staff, and Amin is a very good example of that. He started off with us as an ambulance driver in the 1990s, helping people across the border when they were fleeing from the Soviet and the post-Soviet sort of upheavals in the country. And he's been with us ever since, you know. And in the book, he tells the stories of some of those harrowing moments when he was actually rescuing people. Mm. And the blood that he saw and the times when he came very close to tears because of all that was actually there, the suffering that he saw. And then there are other very good sort of profiles in the book, which shows in a very graphic way the kind of change that we've been able to bring about. And I think one of the messages of the exhibition is, you know, that an agency like us working there consistently with commitment for a long period with the same communities, we've built up trust and we've been able cumulatively to make a difference.
Just when I'm looking at it, I only made it as far as the next spread, or what is certainly, you know, the spread of page 16. And you have a gentleman here, Abdul Latif Hamkar, and I can say to our listeners, he looks like a young Omar Sharif, a very dignified gentleman. He's a project coordinator, or was a project coordinator from the late 80s, early 90s, it says here. And he's in Kapisa in Panjshir, and in this wonderful burgundy shalwar kameez. Just tell me, you know, of course, you set out to chronicle three decades of your work, and one could say that, okay, that's a very focused assignment. But you know, what was the specific brief to sending out the photojournalist to document this? I mean, you know, you only get a good editorial assignment. It's as good as sort of the editors who are going to come back and deal with this.
Yes, well, I mean, we had to try to find stories from staff and from beneficiaries which illustrated the range of our work. And our work is very substantial. I mean, we work in agriculture, we work in veterinary, in the veterinary area. We've been doing a lot of work with the Afghan government. We're implementing partners of this National Solidarity Program, which is actually a very well reviewed program. It's set up elected community councils in over 30,000 villages across the country. And it's actually provided funds for those councils. And it's enabled them to make decisions about, you know, their own development. Mm. And when one goes, I went myself, you know, fairly recently in May to a village in Argu district in Badakhshan, and met the leaders of the council in one of the villages there. And it was quite clear that, you know, cumulatively, over 20 years, Afghan aid had helped to change that community from being, you know, on its uppers, really, to a community that's, you know, got apple orchards, you know, has a better infrastructure, has a health facilities, and is actually a community now which is planning and strategizing for its own development. And, you know, it's this kind of, I think, positive story which doesn't make the headlines, really, because there's so much news about, you know, the war and so on. Mm. It's that kind of story that we want to put across.
And yeah, obviously, as I said at the outset, we're looking at just some color proofs. But I think the level and also the depth of the photojournalism is quite remarkable when you look at it. Just before we went on air, you said that this was largely captured over the past summer. And was there any sense when you're thinking about this that it almost had to be in real time as opposed to being a chronicle? Of course, is the culmination of 30 years' work, but was there any sense that it should be a different type of exhibition and book?
It is in real time in the sense that it's being captured this summer, but we have a timeline. The timeline gives the history of our association, our engagement. It also gives the chronology of what's been happening in Afghanistan since before the Russians invaded to the present day. Mm.
Just before we go, and it's that time of year when people start looking over the horizon. Your prognosis, certainly given the aid work that you've done, but certainly how you view the nation, and certainly of course with a big drawdown on the NATO side as well.
Well, I think there is a huge amount of uncertainty in the air, and one would hope that, you know, some of the changes that have happened have been, you know, transformative. I think, there's going to be some fracturing perhaps of the state as we know it at the moment, but I think that, you know, a great deal has changed, and people are not going to want to go back to the Taliban, and the Taliban, I think, realize that too. And what we're saying, I think, as an agency that's been working there for 30 years, is that because of our long association, we are well equipped, if you like, to carry on working there and giving a development dividend to the people of that country.
David Page, Chair of the Board of Trustees of Afghan Aid, new photo exhibition, 30 years, 30 stories, and a book, a very handsome book accompanying as well. Thanks very much. You're listening to Aperitivo. We're back in a moment.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Лондрис, Нова Йорк, Токио.
Лондон, Нью Йорк, Токио. Dette er Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokiost. Se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 desu.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
And you're listening to Aperitivo here on Monocle 24, just gone 18:55 here in London. I am joined by, tonight's presenter. I hope, are you doing all the shows tonight, Emma Nelson, or?
I am in the process of hoovering them all up.
Are
yes,
you?
I'm doing two.
There's a land grab going on upstairs.
There is, back to back.
And also our producers, I'm not sure if it's both shows tonight or not. Annabelle's also here as well. Welcome both. Let's start with the next major news and current affairs program coming up next. Globalist Asia. What are we looking at, Emma?
20-100 hours London time, Tyler. We will be leading with the end of the trial of the two men accused of being Pol Pot's right-hand men during the Khmer Rouge regime. They gave very defiant statements of denial today that they were not part of the terrible regime that contributed to the deaths of 2 million people in Cambodia in the 1970s. We're also going to be heading to Tunisia, where all hopes for trying to establish some sort of peace full transition to democracy seem to have been put on hold as two bomb attacks, one successful, one unsuccessful, have occurred in the last 48 hours. One of them took place on a beach in front of tourists in the resort of Sousse. So we'll be talking about the effect on Tunisian tourism, which of course has suffered greatly in the last few years due to the Arab Spring and everything that's been associated with it. And finally, the instructions to please switch off all your electronic devices upon takeoff and landing no longer, according to the FAA in the United States.
Yes, it'll be interesting to see how many other nations follow suit on that. I'm quite thrilled. Phones can still stay off, though, as far as I'm concerned. Annabelle, coming up on the Monocle Daily, tell us what we've got.
Well, we've got a jam-packed show. There's a lot been going on in the Americas of late. So we'll be
To Toronto, I bet, won't we?
Yes, we will.
Oh, yes.
Dramatic news that reports confirmed that the video is, in fact, true of Rob Ford smoking nasty substances.
Yes, exactly. And we were talking earlier on the program, one only has to go to the Toronto Star, which has really, I think, been leading much of this investigation. And I've actually been saving it to the end of the program because there's some very dramatic footage that one can feast on. I haven't seen that. So aside from being in Toronto, where else are we going to be?
We'll be in South America and Brazil to assess what has been going on with Ike Batista, who from being one of the world's wealthiest men, is now looking like he's very much struggling on the financial front. And
a gentleman we've covered a lot, certainly when we launched this brand, we always spend a lot of time down in Brazil, but very interesting being with Mr. Batista in Rio, and just an extraordinary fall from grace and quite a dent, which I imagine we'll be looking at to brand Brazil in many ways as well.
Yeah, definitely. We've got a great guest. We'll be speaking to Rogério Simões, who's the executive editor of Epoca Weekly magazine in Brazil. So looking forward to that. And then also...
I'm sorry, breaking the studio. Sorry,
may not be here when you come down a little bit later.
Finally, I was so excited about the final item. We'll be discussing liposuction for people who want to be Marines.
Oh, I love that. And this would be in the United States, I would imagine.
I assume so.
God, you wouldn't want to know what those frogmen would look like. That is all the time we have for today's show. And that show would be Aperitivo. Many thanks, of course, to George Brock and Robert Fox, who are here at the top of the program. This show is produced by Daniel Giacopelli, researched by Alexa Firminich and Harriet Thorpe. And our studio manager has been Claire Urban. Up next is The Urbanist, and that is Andrew Tuck's show. He happens to be the editor of this very fine magazine. As we said, at 2000, it's The Globalist Asia with Emma Nelson. At 2200, it is The Monocle Daily with who? Who's our presenter tonight?
Might be you.
Keep that scarf on. That's all the time we have for news is coming up in about 1 minute and 2 seconds time. Goodbye.
the Rolex Mentor and Protégé Arts Initiative sources young artists across seven disciplines and brings them together with artistic masters for a year of mentoring. For mentors, it's a year to share their passion and expertise. For protégés, it's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to observe and work alongside some of the world's greatest artists. For Rolex, it's a chance to ensure the world's artistic legacy is passed on to the next generation. 1 year can inspire a lifetime.